Welcome to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have as my guest today David Mason, and we'll be discussing Mr. Mason's new verse novel, Ludlow, which is published by Red Hen Press, as well as Mr. Mason will be reading some poems from Arrivals, and then a couple new poems that he has written. So first of all, David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
I actually first discovered your work when I read a book that Dana Gioia gave me called The Poetry of Life, which was The Poetry of Life and the Life of Poetry, a book of essays, which is by Storyline Press, which is a wonderful book. And that was how I was introduced to your work. And then when I read Ludlow, I was really, I really liked the style and the prose that you use. And for listeners, would you describe what a verse novel is, and when you wrote Ludlow, why you chose this particular format to tell the story?
Sure. Well, verse novel is, I suppose, a modern incarnation of something that's been around since the birth of poetry itself, that is, since the time of Homer. Stories have been told in verse, and it became a less common way of managing storytelling in the 19th and 20th centuries. I think the prose market for the novel and the middle class readership that grew in the 19th century, combined with a kind of modernist skepticism about the coherence of stories and about the relation of the poet to his audience, and prevented us from seeing the value, the continued value, in telling stories in verse. Lots of people have written novels in verse, including Vikram Seth and a number of other people, Mark Jarman, etc. And lots of other people have written wonderful narrative poems, Anthony Acton, Robinson Jeffers, and Robert Frost, etc. So in this case, I had the option of writing this novel in prose or writing it in verse, and I simply felt that there was something intensely lyrical, almost epic, in the nature of the story I was telling, and that it suited the story to write it in, for the most part, blank verse. There's an occasional rhyme stanza, and there is, as you say, one tiny passage of prose toward the end of the book. In any case, I really believe that this is a marvelous way to tell stories and to charge stories with a kind of linguistic intensity. And I should say, I think also that some people may pull a verse novel off the bookshelf in a bookstore and look at it and think, oh my God, a long poem. That sounds like something difficult or something that I'd have to study in school. And the truth of the matter is that I don't think reading verse novels is any more difficult than reading novels in prose. And in fact, in some ways it's simpler, because verse technique allows me to economize the storytelling technique and sort of ram the story through in a faster way. So I guess that's the gist of what I would say about verse novels. There's a lot more to say about them.
Sure, sure. And I agree with you. I thought that the book reads very fluidly and is very lyrical, and it's a wonderful form. Tell us a little bit about Ludlow, because it is was an actual coal miners' strike and union organization that actually took place out in Colorado in 1913-1914, and some of the themes are family, landscape, immigration, language, and it really was a unique time in American history that many of us have forgotten, but yeah, a lot of the themes in Ludlow still resonate today.
Well, they really do resonate today. We are a nation of immigrants, and this was a community of immigrants in which some 70% of the people were not English-speaking, and they were indeed maltreated by a handful of companies and corporate interests in places like Manhattan. So there are lots and lots of political and social ramifications of the story that I think are still with us today. But I really want to emphasize that I was less interested in the political piety implied by the story, that is, in turning the immigrants into saintly figures and the company people into horrific villains, than I was in the sense that context. So I really think of it as something of an existential story as much as a political story. I'm trying to help my readers feel the weight of these individual lives and the resonance of these lives in the landscape of the Southwest in America. And so when I'm using little bits of Greek, little bits of Scots dialect, little bits of Spanish woven into the English fabric of the book, what I'm really trying to do is to intensify the language of this place and braid it in with the fabric of the narrative. And in any case, it feels to me, in odd ways, more a personal story than a political story, and yet it has national ramifications.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you have an interlude that you introduce into it, which I thought was very effective the way you did that. David, we talked beforehand, and why don't you read a section of Ludlow for us, and so that the listeners can understand what we're talking about.
Sure. This is a part of a chapter that deals with a Scottish immigrant whose nickname is Too Tall. His name is Too Tall McIntosh. And as you'll see, the narrative voice I've devised for the book can stay very, very close to the minds and lives of my characters, and then can alternately move back and move about the landscape in time and in space. So in this chapter, we're starting in the fall of 1913, and there's a brief moment when the narrative voice leaps ahead to the 1940s during World War II, and you can see how this old man is looking back on the events of Ludlow.
Okay.
The chapter's called Rednecks. Too Tall cursed and stooped from the open tent flap, seeing his missus pinning laundered clothes on a windy line. A fine October day. The sun already scooting from the Black Hills across the flat and open space of Ludlow. His boys had scattered hours before he woke, despite his warning to stay close to camp. It seemed a camp of women to him now. They ran the place. They didn't quit their work when husbands struck. He never meant to strike. But one day, all the men around him dropped their tools in one disgruntled clatter, and he went with them, shared their bottle, and got drunk. And Lefty came and badgered them to join the union. That night, Too Tall met his wife, and she saw instantly what he had done. "You've joined the cause. Well and good. Well and good, you daft man, and fool as well. They'll make us leave and live in tents, and all the work you've done for nothing." "Aye," he managed. "Aye," she answered. And now he took a step like a man learning over again some new technique for walking. Another night's bad whiskey splitting him in two like the dull head of a broad axe. The missus scowled his way but wouldn't talk. Twice in his life, Too Tall had gotten drunk. Well, maybe more than twice, but hardly ever. He was one of those Scots whose work and virtue turned him into the man that others sought, wanting advice from how to lay a charge to splinting broken bones. Not like that Lefty who would break his fist across a stranger's face sooner than ask the time of day of him. Too Tall was dignified, slow to judge, and slower still to act. So on the day he quit the mines, he was not among the first. But he could see that staying in the shack and watching Robles, Lefty, and the others go, his wife and sons would not be safe for long. A man who acts alone is never safe. So it had gone some weeks now, meeting men who talked the strike away as best they could, their women holding family life together, men who chewed or smoked tobacco, looked down at worn boots as they listened. Some had heard how Karl Marx had a system for the poor, and how one day the revolution would upend corruption that made others rich. They talked of capital and labor. Men like that little fella, Tikas, translated for the others, listening with their eyes, their hands itching to do more than wait. Too Tall saw more sorts of people than he'd ever seen. The Japanese who brought tomatoes from abandoned garden plots, the wary Greeks, the Mexicans whose wives worked their metates. And all would listen when John Lawson stood, broad-shouldered in his suit, the meeting tent jammed full of immigrants who sought good news. Now Too Tall stood upright and slowly walked, only found men loitering in and out of the big tent. Antiquus in puttees and suit, barking broken orders. John Mawson strode among them, and the crowd followed him inside the tent. He took the little stage and waited for the quiet, then spoke the bad news from New Mexico. An explosion at the Dawson mine down there, with hundreds buried. Wind touched the canvas overhead, and for a moment no one stirred or shuffled, coughed, or said a word. Whisht, said the wind, and Too Tall thought of Mole and others who had perished in explosions, his own brain now exploding from the hooch. This and John Mawson had a steady voice. These are, he said, our brethren, men like you and me, who spent their whole lives in the dark, and no one knows how many are alive. These are a better reason for the pick and shovel than some black ore for a scion. I want volunteers to board the train with me. The union pays for any man who'll work. And Too Tall hardly thought. His stomach growled. His skull was splitting open, but he had to go. A man who barely walked, he ran now to his missus at the line. And what he felt in giving her the news was the closest thing he knew to happiness. It's work, he said. I don't know what to do with so much idleness. I'll not be long. But when the boys come home, give them a task that's closer to the tents and curry them, no knowing who's about. And even Mrs., her ferocity now gone, reached up and kissed his bearded cheek. That was a kiss he felt for 30 years or more. Days after she was buried, he stood at the gate before their wee house in Pueblo, touching the skin above his whiskers as if his fingertips were a pair of lips, and he might turn to find her there again, calling him by his real name, calling him Christy McIntosh. But she was gone, and they had never made it back to Ayrshire. Never again declared a day was soft, a Sunday not for laboring. A war raged somewhere out of earshot. His own sons too old for it, thank God, but too involved with work and families of their own to stay and visit an old man in a steel town. They'd buried their mum and gone back on the train to Denver and L.A. And Christy walked his hot, dry neighborhood alone each day before his lunch. Sun glint off a windshield. He turned. Some neighbor wasting rationed gas. And once again his fingers touched his cheek. How soft she'd been at their goodbye. And he had never told her all about the fash of Dawson. Her men climbed the scar to dig with any tool they had, the few survivors telling of a misplaced charge, the mine's mouth shooting flames out like a dragon, and now the blackened bodies hauled on tarpaulins down the stumbling slopes, the feared men stunned to silence, body after body, some with burnt arms reaching to death, the flesh in charred strips stiff on the stones, bone and sinew. His cousins in the trenches of the Somme could write of a smell like that, perhaps, the cries of men and animals from no man's land. He saw John Lawson had to dodge the guards, and he saw Tikas, now almost famous due to Ludlow, but then an unknown dandy, work around the clock, knowing many dead were Greek, and many more from Italy. The Corbys flocked to Pinyon Scrub, observing wagons loaded with the sooty sticks that once were men. 263. Our brethren, Lawson said. Then Ludlow. Everything so hard and fast for months. Too few remembered now. The wars had blotted out the past, except old men like Christy McIntosh, who had gone to work to feed his family after the whole turmoil, after the killings and the failures, after the Union sold John Lawson out, after the long disgraceful came to naught. He'd shoveled coke into the furnaces of Pueblo's mill until they made him lead a crew, then moved him to the office where he tallied loads of coal until retirement. 3 decades passing like a dust bowl cloud. A long train wailing through the arid night, freighted with lives he'd never see again. That long train hauled the grief mined from the mesas by the immigrants into a silence like forgetfulness. A gunshot? No. A neighbor's car backfired. He touched his cheek and walked into his house.
Thank you. It's beautiful. Now, let's shift gears here a bit. And, well, first of all, let's put a plug in for Red Hen Press, the publisher of Ludlow, and tell us a little bit about Red Hen Press.
They're a wonderful independent press of Los Angeles, and I've got to say, Mark Cull, the man who designs their books, has done with Ludlow a remarkable job. He's made a stunningly beautiful book, and they print poetry, they print fiction. They're really terrific, hard-working group of people helping to keep literature alive, and probably the best literary press in the state of California going right now, I would think, certainly in the Los Angeles area. And if readers want to find Red Hen Press online, they can go to redhenpress.org, and they'll see the website and get some sense of the books on offer there.
Wonderful. Well, we'll highlight that on the homepage as well, so we'll provide a link because I want to support Red Hen Presses as much as we can, because we need the independent presses. Let's shift gears here, David. And you wrote a book of poems called Arrival, published by Storyline Press in 2004. And we discussed a few of the poems that we both particularly liked. And so rather than me interrupt, I'd like you just to read the poems, and if you feel the need to give a brief introduction to the listener prior to reading the poem, please feel free to do so. But why don't we just go ahead and have you read the poems from Arrivals?
Well, I think one of the first things I would say by way of introduction is that virtually all of my books have something to do with movement, deracination, immigration, and a strong sense of the tentativeness of being and the desire for a stronger consciousness of being alive in the world. Even Ludlow, my verse novel, begins with an epigraph by the great Greek poet George Seferis, which says, "Well, perhaps, no, nothing remains but the weight, the nostalgia for the weight of a living being, where we, the ungrounded ones, now abide." So Arrivals, my third collection of poems, uses the plural in the title because there's an anxiousness about being and about arriving in the world. And I open the book with a translation from another great Greek poet, Constantine Cavafy. And it's a famous poem of Cavafy's called The City, in which you hear two voices, which might be one person speaking to himself or to herself, or it might be two different people talking. The city. "You said, I'll go away to another shore, find another city better than this. In all I attempt, something remains amiss, and my heart, like a dead thing, lies buried. How long will my mind stew in all its worry? Wherever I cast my eye, wherever I look, I see the ruins of my life turn black, here where I wasted and wrecked many a year. You won't find a new land or another shore. This city will follow you. You'll molder in these streets, and these neighborhoods grow older and turn gray among familiar houses. You'll always end here. Don't hope for other places. There is no ship. There is no road for you. Now that you have decided you are through with this place, you've wrecked your life everywhere." Now, Arrivals contains poems set in Greece, in India, in Scotland, in Ireland, and in parts of the United States, especially Washington State, where I was born, and Colorado, which is my ancestral home and where I've lived now for the last 8 years. But my feeling is that no matter where the poems are set, they all have this same anxiousness about being and this same desire to find some sense of rootedness in language and place. it's written in the form of an old Persian form called a ghazal. Mumbai. The crowd's no apparition on Nehru Road, nor the grit of motor rickshaws on Nehru Road, nor the steady pace of people, raga, rock, and all the unheard music of Nehru Road, nor the flowers, the fruit, bowls of sacred colors, the goats and cows that stroll down Nehru Road, the tiffinwallahs, internet cafes, the dogs that lick the pavement of Nehru Road, the girls with perfect skin who wear their saris with a demigoddess air on Nehru Road, the crones who squat, the beggars, and the boy washing himself from a pail on Nehru Road. Commuters lean for air from open doors as the long train leaves the stop on Nehru Road. Mason, you've come to the other side of the world. Why can't you lose yourself on Nehru Road? The next poem I'm going to read is set in Greece, and the title is Agnostos Topos, which is explained in the poem itself, so I don't need to preface it. Agnostos Topos. We had walked a whole day on high ridges, somewhere between the heat-struck sea and peaks, each breath a desert in a traveler's lungs, salt-stung, dusty, like summer's rasping grass and the roughness of stone. Biblical thorns penned us, while the stunted ilex trees shadowed the path. It seemed from these dour fields we could not emerge on anything like a road. A landscape no one had commodified or fenced. If there were gardens here, the poverty of soil defeated them. If there were homes beyond some goatherd's hut, the gravity of ages pulled them down. No sound but cicadas like high-pitched drills ringing till red sunlight hissed into the sea. And that was when, our shins scratched and throats parched, we stumbled into a village on the shore, where people stupefied by days upon days that were the same, told us what to call this place. The distance to a road? 2 cigarettes, said the old man who sat webbing his net. Now the road cuts down from the cliffs above. I've been back, bought wine from the old man's son, who keeps his car parked in an olive shade. It's better, of course, that one can come and go. One needn't stare a lifetime at hot cliffs, thinking them impassable except to goats and men whose speech and features grew like thorns. The old man's dead. The friends I traveled with are long since out of touch. And I'll admit I've lost much of a young man's nimbleness. I call these passing years Agnostos Topos, unknown country, a place of panting lizards. Yet how like home it seemed when I walked down out of the unfenced hills, thirsty, footsore, with words of greeting for the fishermen. You know, the book also contains a long, disturbing narrative poem called The Collector's Tale, which frankly is too obscene to be read on the air, as it were. So I'm going to move toward the latter half of the book and another poem that suggests some of the anxiousness about being that underlies the book. It's a poem called Adam Speaks. When I was clay, there was so much to feel. Symmetries of sunlight traced within the feather and the leaf. Pale secretions trailing from shells, the clammy hands of fog touching my body. My first uncurling into day was built from muted fires below, and I began to grow distinct. Bone, nail, and hair. Muscled, akimbo, awkward as the farm I later named. There was a sea inside my flesh. I tensed to hold it in, but the whisper of the moon calling to me. You who are thinking of me then, remember, I tore myself out of myself, bellowing like thunder. When I saw birds, I thought they were the love of God, and wailed at how they flew above me. I'm going to turn now to some poems that are more openly personal. The first one is a sequence of very short lyrics. It's called Small Steps, and I suppose it's about trying to emerge from a little period of depression some years ago. And the other motif that's woven through the poem is the image of Frankenstein, who I think is rather like you and me, because Frankenstein is a life made of other lives, made of the pieces of other people, galvanized and brought to life, and has to learn language and try to learn how to live in this crazy world. So that's a sort of thread in this poem that's called Small Steps. Open the book of losses. You will see that it begins with early morning light, the stillness of a house where children sleep. Not your own, unless love can make them yours. They lie in their beds or in the crib upstairs. The furnace breathes. Outside, no breath of wind. No one commutes to work just yet. No deer feed in the yard, as if the world could breathe, just breathe, so still that you might think it found repose. A friend on oxygen is dying in a city not so far away. No doubt she lies sleeping now. Perhaps her husband sits awake, like you. A cup of coffee steaming on the kitchen table, where he writes, like you. Emptied of everything, leaving his small tracks on the page. You read of a man without a wife, who had a plan to make a life. The Promethean spark brought down to earth, served in the dark new creature's birth. But the creature walked in pain, alone. It wrote, it talked, it prayed for one that would not scream at its ugliness. It learned to dream and to confess. I think of that lurching creature even now, watching a child whose smile and clumsy steps delight the adults in the living room. The sounds she makes are like the sounds of birds during a downpour. She balances and walks, reaching her mother's outstretched arms. Applause, applause, enough to satisfy the soul entire minutes with real blessedness. When was it I began to feel this distance, the self I dreamed of now mildly grotesque? Oh yes, nature. There is nature. The consolation of the trees, birdsong again that calls you back, delight of that first flight across the desert floor. A window frames the constant flutter of the leaves within its stillness, green, enlarged from what they were just days ago. Breathe, just breathe, and watch them scatter, held in their summer atmosphere. Given a watch, I knew the catch. Hearing the latch, I watched the door. What is it for if it closes fast? Nothing will last, traveling past all you adore. Each day you must cross from desolation. You do this for no one, and no one else will ever do it for you. Foot by foot, your body made of past lives brought to life. Each memory dispelled or trembled over as you drive to work or spend the day off watching the school of leaves beyond the glass. Do not expect so much, they seem to say. The joy you've lost is only seasonal. You must be patient. Start again. Small steps will have to do now for the awkward creature that you are. The child you watch, though not your own, will teach you never to presume of life. A deer steps, light as a breath from the wood, flickers across the morning stippled road, and leaps into shade like a brown trout in a pool. A yellow bus children down to school. The mug of coffee on the open book trembles slightly when a rumbling truck ascends the hill outside. You listen, then get up from the kitchen chair and cap your pen. Never mind that we are dying. The only purpose of the song is to stop the baby's crying. She'll not be a child for long. Watch the infant cross the carpet. Watch the young girl learn to dance. She's on her own. You cannot stop it, saving her from choice and chance. Never mind the grief that wakes you. Think of the alternative where every kind of touch forsakes you. Stop lamenting now and live. Over the city where the friend is dying. Over the suburbs, a red tail is flying. Over the freeway, throbbing at rush hour. Over the ponytail prairie shower, brushing gray shadows across the long grass. And over the hills and the mountain pass. Over and over, the mind circles back, bending the branch that covers the track. The red tail above you, wheeling in flight. Day becomes night, becomes day, becomes night.
That's wonderful.
I'll just switch to a deeply personal poem right now and finish from Arrivals with this one. It's called Swimmers on the Shore. And this is just a flat-out true story about a moment when we realized that my father had Alzheimer's. It's set in Washington State on Whidbey Island, and it's called Swimmers on the Shore. Like half a filial circus act, splashing the Y pool shallow end, I swam about my father, who could stand. And when I climbed, an acrobat diving from his muscled shoulders, they seemed as solid as two boulders. Now I can hold his shrunken frame in my arm's compass. We're together at a park bench in lingering summer weather before I make the long drive home. But halfway through some story, speech lies suddenly beyond his reach. I see him cast for words and fail. Though talking never came with ease, it is as if my father's memories dissolve in a cedar-darkened pool, while I no longer am aware which of us goes fishing there. Has he begun the long swim out towards silence that we all half dread? I hug my father's shoulders, lean my head closer to his. Yet I cannot, from his unfinished sentences, quite fathom where or who he is. I want to stay. The day is warm. The salt breeze blows across the sound, long plaintive cries of seagulls sailing down to hover over churning foam there in the docking ferry's wake. I want to stay for my own sake, holding the man who once held me until I dove and splashed about. He gives my hand a squeeze. There is no doubt, despite his loss of memory, and though the words could not be found, it's I who have begun to drown.
That's beautiful, David.
Thank you.
You were kind enough to send me a couple of new poems you're working on. And
yeah.
One of the goals when I started this website 3 years ago was to keep alive the memory of great writers that have come before us. So let's dedicate these two poems to Anthony Hecht.
Absolutely.
A man who's I had the good fortune and grace to interview Anthony 4 months before he died. It's the last recorded interview, and he was one of the finest gentlemen and greatest poets of our time. So let's think of Anthony and have you read two of your new poems for the listeners to conclude the show.
Absolutely, and I'd just like to add that Tony Hecht was my teacher and my friend, and I miss him greatly. I feel that the world of American poetry is greatly diminished without his presence. as one coherent line. How the hell they get this power over us? Then logic shatters, and a silent whine crosses his face. My father's spotted hands flutter like dying moths. I take them up and lead him in a paranoiac dance toward the parking lot and our escape. He is my boy, regressed at 82 to mooncalf prominence, drugged and adrift. And I can only play remembering who he was not long ago, a son, bereft. Strapped in the car, he sleeps away the hour we're caught in currents of the interstate. He will be ashes in a summer shower and sink to roots beneath the winter's weight. And finally, a little poem about childhood called Hangman. A big chief tablet and a bic between us on the car's back seat. The scaffold drawn, and underneath a code of dashes in a row for seven letters. Part of a stick figure fixed to the noose's O for every letter missed. Until if I'm not careful, my poor guy will hang with X's for his eyes. My brother parlays his resource for big boy words with taunting skill. It starts with D and rhymes with force. But I don't know the word. Don't know the wet world being slapped away by wiper blades, or why the day moved like an old stop-action film, or an interrupted TV show about a family on the lam. I let myself be hanged and learn a new word whispered out of fear, though it will be another year before I feel the house cut loose, my dangling body and the burn of shame enclosing like a noose.
Thank you very much. I love those two new poems. Is this part of a collection, David, that you're working on?
I think I'm more or less finished with a new collection that might be called The Inland Sea. But I need to let it sit for a little longer to see whether I'm right about that.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Casey.
One of the things I remember, I'll never forget the first time I heard Anthony Hecht read his poetry, the thought hit me, to really get the depth of poetry, it is so helpful to hear it read aloud by the poet.
Yeah.
And I urge all of the listeners to go out and buy a copy of Ludlow, support Red Hen Press, and let's keep poetry alive and well, because it's an integral part of our nation's heritage, and we all need to do everything we can to support it. So thanks for being a guest, and when the new collection comes out, we'll have you back on and hear some of the other ones that you've written as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, you take care, David.
Okay, bye-bye.